The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday, and I'm delighted to welcome back for the very first time this year my dear friend, Dr. Peter Hammond. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
Yes, thank you, Andrew. I'm back with you.
It's great to have you back. It's been lonely over here. You're the only person that I talk to now on the show. So I'm delighted to have you back. What Peter has for us today is a very timely topic, because 80 years ago, in 2 days' time, this Thursday, the Wilhelm Gustloff was sunk. So today's show title is The Real Story of the Sinking of the MV Wilhelm Gustloff 80 years ago on January the 30th, 1945. So, Peter, where would you like to start us off with this important topic?
It's quite tragic that if you ask most people to name what is the greatest ship disaster or maritime disaster in history, you'll usually get the response of the Titanic, which, of course, there's a major Hollywood epic which had a big screen, not only run, but it also got a whole lot of Oscars. And so most people think the Titanic is the greatest sea disaster of all time, but this one was five times worse in terms of number of casualties. Over 9,000 people drowned or died in explosions when the Soviet submarine S-13 torpedoed the Wilhelm Gustloff, which was a medical refugee transport vessel taking people away in the Baltic Sea from the advancing Red Army. And the people that fled to the ship, they were all feeling so relieved that they were safe now. They had escaped from the Red Army. They were escaping from the Baltic states. They were heading for Germany to Kiel. And most had no idea that there could be any severe danger like this. And staggering is that more than half of all those who drowned or died in that sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff, 30th January 1945, more than half were children. And overwhelming majority were women and children, but that is just staggering that most people don't even know that it happened. So this is quite extraordinary. If you ask the average person what's the worst sea disaster, I've heard some people say Lusitania, some even said the USS Arizona, which of course was the ship that lost the most lives in the attack on Pearl Harbor. Some have even mentioned Empress of Ireland or Andrea Doria, but Titanic normally gets top billing. And that's because the Hollywood film. But perhaps Wilhelm Gustloff will start to be better known in the future. But right now, it's like a subject you're not allowed to bring up. And the reason is, first of all, it occurred during wartime. And some of that's considered less tragic, apparently, when you have people dying in wartime than in peacetime. And it's happened to the losing side, where most of the archival information on the Wilhelm Gustloff was destroyed when the Blom and Voss shipbuilding company was bombed during the war. In the last days of the war, with the Allied 1,000 bomber raids coming over relentlessly, pounding the cities into nothingness and ashes and incinerations, the main ship company that owned the vessel had all their archives and so on destroyed. And unfortunately, many people had the attitude after the war that it didn't matter what happened to Germans, they were just Nazis, you know, this kind of refrain where you, well, they've got war guilt, and this propagandizing, demonizing the enemy to such an extent that many people felt, who cares about even civilians and babies and children from the defeated side? So there was also the attitude of, well, this is the Soviets or the Russians' just retribution for defeats they suffered at the hands of German forces. When the German army invaded Soviet Russia in Operation Barbarossa in 1941, their tactics were often quite brutal, because Hitler himself made clear this is a different war from anything we're waging in the West. The Soviet Union steadfastly refused to recognize the Geneva Convention, and so when Germany attacked Russia, it was like the gloves were off. This is a fight to the death between National Socialism and International Socialism, nationalism versus communism, and it was seen as the titanic battle between ideologies. The way it was put in Germany in many cases was, this is Europe fighting against Eurasia. And the whole idea was, this is a battle of civilizations, and there was little mercy extended on either side. And now it seemed the Soviets, who were advancing and on the ascendancy, thanks to all the lend-lease and the vast amounts of tanks and trucks and weaponry and ammunition they were receiving from the West free, or paid for by South African gold, as it turned out. But nevertheless, this somehow was seen that the Soviets had the right to extract vengeance even on civilians because of all the hideous defeats they'd suffered on the Eastern Front. Well, it would have been the Western Front from the perspective of the Russians, but the Eastern Front from the German perspective. Now, under normal circumstances, 4,500 innocent children dying in any one single disaster would be mourned by almost anyone within a friendly or an enemy nation, but not here. But the big thing about the Wilhelm Gustloff, which makes it a subject that you wonder, why has this not been the subject of a major Hollywood film? Well, the strip was named for a prominent German leader who was assassinated by a Jewish assassin. So Wilhelm Gustloff was actually the leader of the National Socialist Democratic Workers' Party in Switzerland, NSDAP in Switzerland. He was the Swiss leader of the National Socialists, and he was assassinated by a Jewish student, to quote it nicely, or assassin or terrorist. And because the ship was named after him, it's a bit embarrassing to even bring up the name of the ship for the Allies. So the Allies wouldn't have wanted to remind people of atrocities committed or war crimes committed by an ally, in this case the Soviet Union, which, despite being one of the worst regimes in history, was the ally of the West in their war for democracy, freedom, and Christian civilization, even though it was actually against it. The other reason why you may not hear much about this is the captain of the Soviet submarine, the S-13, was Captain Alexander Marinescu, and he was in disgrace. He had been found in drunk in brothels in town, and he was late getting the submarine off because of his drunken indiscretions, and this made his character, to quote the official Soviet report, incompatible with the Soviet ideal. He wasn't much of a hero. He was a drunken whoremonger, to be honest. But his reputation was eventually resurrected many years later in 1960 by the Soviet government and awarded Hero of the Soviet Union Award because they described it as a hero who sunk a fascist ship filled with military personnel only, which is a blatant lie. It was filled overwhelmingly with civilian refugees and women and children. And the demise of so many refugees, mostly women and children, in such a terrible disaster in one of the most powerful ships of all time. In fact, you know, when Germany made a film on the Titanic during the war, the Wilhelm Gustloff was used as the prop in the film. So it was, they used the Wilhelm Gustloff to double for the Titanic, because it was also a colossal, huge ship, over 2,000 meters long. That's two football fields in length. And it was one of the biggest ships in the world, and it was a really advanced ship. And the loss of this ship, which was the symbol of unity of the German folk, and which had once been the flagship of the Strength Through Joy program, where they provided holidays for the workers of Germany. This was such a blow that not even the German propaganda department wanted to broadcast this. And so neither side wanted to broadcast this terrible atrocity for morale reasons on the German side and for moral reasons on the Western side, where they didn't want to highlight the fact that their allies were committing such war crimes. And you could also add very cynically that there were no American personnel on the ship. There's no Hollywood celebrities. There's no world-renowned bankers, no great rich people on the ship. And so for this reason, there's not likely to be an American film on it. Even more likely because it's named after a martyr who was assassinated by Jewish terrorists. So you can see why no film's been made on the Wilhelm Gustloff, and most people are oblivious of it because it doesn't even appear in the average textbook on the Second World War. The fact is that MV Wilhelm Gustloff was a German medical refugee transport ship sunk on the 30th of January 1945, 80 years ago this week, by the Soviet submarine S-13 in the Baltic Sea, while evacuating mostly civilians from East Prussia and from the Baltic States. Not only Germans were on board ship, there were also Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians. There were people, Finns, people fleeing from the Red Army. And according to the best estimates now, we know that over 9,400 people died, making it the largest loss of life in a single ship sinking in history. So originally, the Wilhelm Gustloff was constructed as a cruise ship for the Strength Through Joy or Kraft Durch Freude organization, 1937. And the Wilhelm Gustloff was requisitioned by the Kriegsmarine, the Navy in Germany, in 1939 on the outbreak of war and in September 1939. And so she served as a hospital ship through 1939 and 1940, and later was serving as some kind of floating barracks for naval personnel in Danzig before being fitted with some anti-aircraft guns, put into service to evacuate refugees in 1945. And the fact that she had some anti-aircraft guns showed they thought their greatest threat was from Red Air Force bombers that might bomb them. They didn't seem to think of a real threat from submarines. The Wilhelm Gustloff was constructed by the Blom & Voss shipyards in Kiel, and it was 208 meters long. It was 23 meters wide and had a capacity of 25,000 gross tons, gross registered tons. That's before you put all the equipment and furniture and people on board. Launched the 5th of May, 1937. Interestingly, the ship was originally intended to be named Adolf Hitler, but Hitler decided he didn't want the ship named after himself. And sitting next to the widow of Wilhelm Gustloff at the funeral of the leader after he had been assassinated by what they described as a Jewish medical student, Hitler decided the name should be changed to Wilhelm Gustloff. And it completed the sea trials in 1938, handed over to the owners, the first purpose-driven cruise ship for German Labour Front, or the DAF, the Deutsche Arbeitsfront, and used for the Strength Through Joy campaign, where providing recreational cultural activities for poor people who wouldn't normally be able to have a luxurious holiday. And this was so amazing and so unprecedented in the world at that time that the ship was not allowed to dock in British ports because the British were terrified that if their workers saw the luxury being provided for the common man in Germany, it would undermine morale in Britain and cause some kind of a revolt against the British government. So it was amazing that on one of its earliest voyages, April 1938, the Wilhelm Gustloff performed a heroic rescue of the crew of the Pegaway ship, and they were in the North Sea and meant to be linking up with three other Strength to Joy vessels, Der Deutschland, Oceania, and Sierra Cordoba, on a group cruise of the North Sea, when a terrible storm of winds of up to 100 kilometers an hour arose that chased the four ships apart. And at this same time, a 1,800-ton coal freighter, the Pegaway, which had departed from Tyne and was heading towards Hamburg, got caught up in the storm. The cargo and the machinery was washed off the decks. The ship lost maneuverability. The storm increased in intensity. The ship started taking up on water and began sinking. And when at 4 a.m., Captain Ward of the Pegaway issued an SOS, the ship was 20 nautical miles northwest of the island of Terschelling off the coast of the Netherlands. And the closest ship to answer the distress call was Willem Gustloff, which reached the Pegaway just 2 hours later at 6 a.m. She launched her first lifeboat, which had a crew of 12 but was only oar-powered, and it was unable to come alongside the Pegaway because of the high seas. It was in danger of needing to be rescued itself. And so the lifeboat number 6 with a outboard motor was launched, and that was able to handle the waves, rescue the first lifeboat, which was getting in distress in the storm, and then pulled alongside the Pegaway and allowed all 19 men on board the Pegaway to board into their lifeboat before the Pegaway sunk. And it soon rolled to port, sank, and yet the Willem Gustloff saved everyone on board the Pegaway. They had a few other adventures, taking Austrian citizens on cruise vessels as well. They also served as a polling station for German and Austrian citizens living in England who wanted to vote in a plebiscite on Germany's unification with Austria. So the 10th of April, 1938, over 1,000 Germans and over 800 Austrians who were eligible voters ferried from the docks at Tilbury in England to the ship where they cast their votes. 1,968 votes cast in favor of Union, Anschluss, only 10 voted against. And once the voting was complete, the Willem Gustloff returned to Hamburg, and it undertook many voyages. And the Willem Gustloff actually transported 80,000 passengers on 60 different voyages in its civilian cruise duties between 1938 and 1939, before war broke out. In fact, May 1939, the Willem Gustloff was diverted from the pleasure cruisers to transport wounded soldiers from the Condor Legion back to Germany from Spain, following the victory of the nationalist forces under General Franco in the Spanish Civil War. So from the 14th of March 1938 till the 26th of August 1939, the Willem Gustloff transported 80,000 passengers on a total of 60 voyages all around Europe. And it was serving as a hospital ship then from September 1939 through to November 1940 in the Baltic Sea. And it saved many lives, so it had an illustrious history and background. But Operation Hannibal was 1945, evacuation of German civilians and other Baltic civilians from East Prussia and from the Baltic states as the Red Army advanced from the east, raping, murdering, pillaging, causing absolute havoc in its wake. And so the Willem Gustloff's final voyage was to evacuate civilians, German military personnel, technicians from East Prussia, from Danzig, and many of them had fled from the Red Army in ox wagons and horse carts and walked long distances in horrifying freezing cold. And there was such a sense of relief when they reached the ship. They thought now they were safe. The ship's complement and passengers listed over 6,000 people on board, even though the ship was made for 1,500 passengers. But there were many, many who passed, even after they'd run out of boarding cards. And the German officers controlling the ship understood what the people were fleeing from. They didn't want to turn anyone away. They even drained the swimming pool to accommodate more women into the swimming pool section. And every area they could, they provided. So people were sleeping literally in passageways. And the place was packed. They think there were something like 12,000 people, refugees, on board the ship. And this included, officially, 173 naval forces auxiliaries, included 918 officers and NCOs of the Navy, including of the U-boat section, 373 naval auxiliaries were women, 162 wounded soldiers, 8,957 civilians, and there were over 10,500 passengers officially on board, but it's believed it was probably closer to 12,000. and the ship was very overcrowded and many passengers, because the heat took off their life jackets, which by law they were required to wear because of the extreme conditions. And aside from Germans, there were Latvians, Lithuanians, Poles, Estonians, Croatians, and who were also on board. And many, many, many of them were children. So the ship departed on the 30th of January at 12:30 p.m., so in the early hours of the 30th of January, and they were accompanied by just two torpedo boats for protection on the Baltic Sea. And they carried on board no protection from submarines. About the only protection from submarines could have been provided by the torpedo boats. But interestingly, against the advice of the military commander, Lieutenant Commander Willem Zijn, who is a submariner, he argued for a course in shallow waters close to the shore without lights. And the captain, Frederick Petersen, decided to head for the deep water, which had been cleared of mines. There was a danger of hitting mines on the closer to coast side, the shallow waters. And so it was a bit of a trade-off between danger from mines or danger from submarines. And so Petersen decided to activate his red and green navigation lights to avoid a collision in the dark, because they were told that there was a an oncoming convoy coming towards them, which actually turned out not to be true. So the ship was traveling with navigation lights on, and the submarine S-13 just surfaced at the point that the lights were switched on and could actually see the vessel very clearly. And with the lights on, should have known that this is not a military transport. This must be a civilian transport, or it wouldn't have its navigation lights switched on in the middle of a war. So submarine S-13, commanded by Captain Alexander Marinescu, saw that they had a target in sight. They surfaced. Now, interestingly, the two torpedo boats that the Willem Gustloff was being escorted by, one of them had their submarine sensor on board frozen, so it was inoperable, and that left the vessel somewhat defenseless. The other torpedo boat was on the far side, and the submarine surfaced on the coastal side of the Willem Gustloff and decided to attack. Around 9 p.m., Marinescu ordered his crew to launch four torpedoes at the Willem Gustloff. And I think these torpedoes were named for the motherland, the Joseph Stalin, and there were a couple of other communist-type slogans. One of the torpedoes jammed in the tube, and the other three launched. And all three torpedoes struck the Willem Gustloff on her port side. The first struck the ship's bow, causing the watertight doors to seal off automatically. And so off-duty crew members were sleeping in areas that were now sealed off so they couldn't escape. The second hit the accommodations for the women's naval auxiliary in the drained swimming pool. And only three of the women survived out of 373 who were quartered in the actual swimming pool area. And that's quite a story how three even survived. So the third torpedo scored a direct hit on the engine room, which is about amidships, and this disabled all power and communications and plunged the vessel into darkness. Now, reportedly, only nine lifeboats could be lowered because the ship listed dramatically 15 degrees to port, and so many of the boats could not be launched on the far side. And the ropes were so frozen, it was minus 10 to minus 18 degrees Celsius. So in this freezing conditions, they couldn't actually launch themselves on the ship. And there's a young boy who had a penknife with him, and that enabled him to cut themselves loose just because one person had a knife. And it made all the difference for 70 passengers who were crammed into that one longboat. And there's all kinds of interesting stories like that, how little things made a difference between whether people lived or died. And so reportedly, only nine lifeboats were able to be launched out of the 18 that they had on board. And many people died directly because of the torpedoes, explosions, and many drowned in the onrushing waters. But I think most died because of the freezing cold of the waters, which was something like 10 to -14 degrees Celsius, which is from 14 to 0 degrees Fahrenheit. And there were ice floes actually covering the water, and so most people would have succumbed to exposure in the freezing waters. In less than 40 minutes after being struck by the torpedoes, the Wilhelm Gustloff was lying on its side and sank bow first 10 minutes later into 44-meter water. So the ship to this day is not that far from the surface and causes a bit of a potential hazard for people navigating with ships in that area. The German forces in the torpedo boats around were able to rescue 1,252 people. The torpedo boat T-36 rescued 564. The torpedo boat Low rescued 472. The minesweeper M-387 rescued 98 people. Another minesweeper rescued 43 survivors. Another minesweeper got 37. And then a steamer, the Göttingen, rescued another 28 people later. The torpedo recovery boat TF-19 rescued another 7. The freighter Gotland rescued another 2. And a patrol boat rescued 1 baby, incredibly, the last one to be rescued. And 13 of the survivors died later in hospital. All 4 captains on board the Wilhelm Gustloff actually survived her sinking. And a naval inquiry was initiated specifically against the U-boat commander, Lieutenant Commander Zane, and his degree of responsibility was never resolved because of the collapse of Germany under the Allied invasions in 1945. So the figures made that, according to the best research, 9,343 men, women, and children died on the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff. And they have undertaken extraordinary exhibitions into this. The Marine Exodus software estimated 9,600 people died of the people on board, taking into account the passenger density and the simulation of escape routes, survivability, and all the rest. Now, many ships were sunk during the war, and based on all the estimates and calculations, the Wilhelm Gustloff remains by far the largest loss of life in any sinking of a single vessel in maritime history. And interesting, the Soviets used real propaganda and reported at the time that the ship was filled with SS personnel drawn from concentration camps, which is absolute nonsense. And there were other ships that were sunk, like the General von Steuben, with 4,500 people lost, all refugees trying to escape. And the Captain Marinescu had been facing a court-martial due to his alcoholism, drunkenness, and brothel activities. And so he was not deemed suitable to be a hero, so the Soviets didn't give him the Hero of the Soviet Union, but the Order of the Red Banner. And he is downgraded from captain to lieutenant and dishonorably discharged from the Soviet Navy October 1945. But in 1960, Marinescu, the responsible Soviet captain who had shot the torpedoes into this refugee vessel, was given a reinstatement as captain third class, granted full pension by the Soviet communist government in 1960. And he died just a few weeks later at age 50 from cancer. In 1990, Marinescu was actually posthumously awarded Hero of the Soviet Union by Mikhail Gorbachev. So Mikhail Gorbachev is meant to be such a great detente person and all that. He decided to honor this drunken, whoremongering, mass murderer, war crime criminal, a Hero of the Soviet Union, just showing the kind of character of not just Gorbachev, but the Soviet Union itself. And so it's an absolute disgusting tragedy. There have been a few books written. There's a German author, Günter Grass, who wrote the book Krebsgang, which is translated into English as Crab Walk. And he gives a historical story with some fictional characters to depict this tragedy. And Ruta Sepitz wrote Salt to the Sea, which is about the lives of 4 fictional characters during the evacuation from East Prussia and the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff. I'll Be Damned is an autobiography of a German-born American actor, Eric Braden, published by HarperCollins in 2017, describes how as a young boy, his father refused to allow his family on board the ship in last minute because he felt it was overcrowded. And so he survived. He should have been on the ship, but he was not because his father was concerned about the overcrowding. So that's I'll Be Damned. Then there's other books, The Other Side of Silence, which is written by Philip Kerr. It includes in its plot the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff and combines some historical facts with fictional characters. There's a Danish book published in 1999, which also has some fictional characters in the Wilhelm Gustloff event. Christopher Dobson wrote the book The Cruelest Night, 1979, and Darkness Fell on Gottenhafen, a feature film by Frank Weisbaum in 1960. Der Gustloff was a two-part television series produced in 2008 on German TV. Killer Submarine, an episode of History's Mysteries in 1999. Die große Flucht, The Great Escape, The Sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff, was published in 2001. The Sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff by the Sea Hunters television program in 2002. An Unsolved History television program in 2003 published Wilhelm Gustloff, The World's Deadliest Sea Disaster. It also appeared in 2008 in National Geographic, a film documentary calling The Sinking of Hitler's Supership. That came out in 2008. And then 2012, Triumph and Tragedy of the Wilhelm Gustloff, a German film produced in 2012. So here you've got a major sea disaster which deserves a top film billing and drama such as what you had on the Titanic. I mean, you could make a far more dramatic film on this than you could on the Titanic. And yet it's never been a major subject of a major Hollywood film at all. It deserves a lot more. The least we can do is remember it. But there is an online Wilhelm Gustloff Museum, which you can find on the web, where they've collected all the books and films, all the pictures, postcards, tickets, any memorabilia to do with Wilhelm Gustloff. And so you can visit the Wilhelm Gustloff Museum online, and that's an interesting source of good information. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. I'm just going to mute you for a moment because I'm coming back through your getting feedback because, as people know, Skype throttles you if you haven't spoken for a while. So just wait for that to go away, which it seems to have done now. So very sad story, but very timely to bring it up, being as the 80th anniversary is on Thursday in 2 days' time. So something else that I think people will be interested to hear, Peter, is what you've been up to these last 3 weeks, just to let the audience know, because it's something you do every year, and everyone listening could participate at the next one. Is that right?
That's correct. So we had an intensive 3-week Great Commission course, which included something like 14 devotionals and sermons, over 60 lectures, of which I presented 40. We dealt with everything from evangelism, missions, practical survival skills, and so on. We had special seminars to do with Muslim evangelism, person evangelism, film evangelism, and we did all kinds of practicals, outreaches. We went on the streets and were able to pray with and counsel dozens of people to the Lord at Rondebosch, at Greenpoint, at Seapoint, major outreaches. We went into a Muslim stronghold, Burkop, and did evangelism amongst the mosques and amongst many Muslim people there. We went into a mosque and had discussions and debates with some Muslim leaders, and we had all kinds of intriguing opportunities. We went to the oldest mission station in the Southern Hemisphere, Gnadendal, where the missionary George Schmidt walked from Germany to the Netherlands, spent years as a slave and prisoner in Salzburg, Austria, for evangelizing Catholics. When he escaped from there, he walked to the Netherlands to get permission to travel to the Cape of Good Hope, where I'm based, in order to set up the first mission station here. And he baptized the first Bushmen and Hottentots to the Lord back in the 1730s already. And so this mission station dates back to the 1700s, an incredibly interesting mission station, wonderfully built, modeled in many cases on Heeren, on Herrenhut in Germany. Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf started this prayer meeting in Herrenhut that lasted 150 years, 24 hours a day, prayer chain going 7 days a week, 365 days a year for 150 years. And during that extraordinary prayer chain, they sent out 2,500 missionaries throughout the world, as far as Greenland's icy mountains and Ceylon Isle, to the Caribbean and to the Cape of Good Hope, where we went to this oldest mission station in the Southern Hemisphere. And so Knoordendal was a fascinating, inspiring visit. We went to the Castle of Good Hope, the largest, oldest building in the Southern Hemisphere as well, built by the Dutch back in the 1660s, and a really magnificent, interesting historical visit. We had day visits like that. We were able to teach our people a lot, lots of hikes and outreaches. During one of the hikes up Lion's Head, which is quite a challenging mountain, I took a tumble, lost my footing in the dark. We were coming down around midnight, and I fell and hit my side against the rock and cracked a rib. X-ray later confirmed I had a fractured rib. And, of course, that's quite painful, but there's nothing you can do about it. All they can do is say rest, which I couldn't do. I had everything from PT in the morning to hikes at night and lots of lectures in between. So we carried on with our outreaches. And on the last night, which happened to be my 65th birthday, we hiked up Table Mountain. I led that, even though I had a lot of people saying you shouldn't do it because of the cracked rib. But I felt that I couldn't, in good conscience, avoid my duty. And I've led these hikes every year for over 28 years. I wasn't going to stop now. So we ended up with the high point of climbing Table Mountain, which is over 1,000 meters high, over 3,000 feet high above sea level. And it was a very long hike. We started at 11 in the afternoon. We finished at 1 in the morning, so it was a very long slog up and over Table Mountain. But we had the opportunities to witness to people, even distribute gospel literature while hiking. Our people felt a tremendous sense of accomplishment beating these hikes. And it wasn't just hikes carrying your food and water, but each person was carrying a whole lot of gospel literature as well, boxes of Arabic scriptures, in fact, because weight training is important, and it's not just covering the distance and being strong, but you need to be in the field. Missionaries have to be carrying literature. So we were all carrying gospel literature, even the woman in the team, and there was a tremendous sense of satisfaction to accomplish this. It was the kind of grueling endurance hikes that we were made to do in the army, what we call fuss baits or bite fasts, where you just got to endure. And so we accomplished that, and I was drenched with sweat, all kinds of cramps and aches and pains from muscles I didn't know I had. But to be able to have the health and strength to do that in my 60s, I just praise God. It's a gift, it's a privilege, and I'm glad that I didn't give in to the temptation to just duck out because I had a fractured rib. So that's what we've just finished. We also had a one-week Biblical Worldview Summit before this. And the Great Commission course is our most intense time during the year. You can imagine when you start with PT at 6:30 in the morning and finish hikes at midnight or 1 in the morning. Those are very busy days. And it's meant to prepare people for missions. It's a selection and training process for people wanting to join us. But it's preparation for missions. There's assignments, there's exams, there are sermons to be prepared. There's all kinds of research assignments, active things, exams on everything from missions, the Bible, Bible exams, part of it, map work, and seeing people's understanding of the geography of mission fields around the world. There were maps of Europe and America and the world and Africa to complete, all as part of the experience. So we had Bible drill, we had debating skills, games of just a minute and so on. It was packed, it was varied, full. We had a lot of very good, inspiring films also that our people watched. And we incorporated the most intense training possible for evangelism and Muslim evangelism and apologetics as well. And so there's quite a lot of history that came in too, and examples of excellence from history. David Livingston, C.T. Studd, Hudson Taylor, William Carey. Those are some of the case studies we studied as well, all in the goal of advancing people to be more effective in missions. So that's what we've been up to. And at this moment, we actually have a missionary in the field in the Congo, a naval officer. Most of us are army and infantry background, but Johan Menkes is a naval officer. In fact, he was on the bridge of the South African destroyer, the President Kruger, when it sank. So he was involved in the worst naval disaster in South African history. He went down with the ship, the President Kruger. But now he's done a full survey of the Congo River Basin, and there are 18 million people living on the Congo River and its basin, the Congo jungle, who can only be reached by river, by boat. There's no roads and there's no airfields that can reach them. So we've got a mission field of 18 million people who have virtually no churches or Bibles amongst them, who can only be reached by the river. And so we've launched the Congo River Mission, and that's one of our challenges right now, to support him, especially as a new war has erupted in the Congo. And South African troops have been up there and been killed in the conflicts. There are rebels from Rwanda who are involved in this fight. There's some of the Rwandese military involved. There are many different nations' forces involved, especially as the Interahamwe mass murderers who committed the genocide in Rwanda back in 1945. Many of the culprits and their relatives fled to the Congo. And so Rwanda's trying to prevent a recurrence of the genocidal attacks on the Tutsi tribe in Rwanda and their preemptive strikes into the Congo. And this is part of the mix. But complicating the matters is a lot of minerals like diamonds in the Congo. And so there's some real exploitative events taking place, governments getting involved, armies from all kinds of nations. About 12 different countries are involved in the Congo. You've got Angolan forces there, you've got Tanzanians, you've got a Mozambique army there. There's all sorts of forces involved in the Congo trying to exploit the mineral riches of the country. And obviously that complicates life and makes ministry very hard. But we'd certainly appreciate the prayers and support of listeners for what is going on in the Congo. Our missionary there, Johan, is desperately trying to get an outboard motor that he can power his long canoe around instead of just by oars and paddles, which you can imagine is very inefficient and difficult in a massive raging river that sometimes widens to 17 miles in width during the rainy season. This is one of the biggest rivers in the world in terms of volume, not in terms of length. The Nile is the longest river, but the Congo is one of the biggest rivers in the world. It's the original Heart of Darkness, which Henry Morton Stanley traversed and which inspired the book, The Heart of Darkness. But yes, so that's some of what we've been involved in and are involved in at this moment. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And a couple of quick questions. Firstly, the Biblical Worldview Summit, that is the same as the first week of the Great Commission course. Am I correct?
That is correct. So more people come to the Biblical Worldview Summit, which is primarily aimed at preparing those about to go to university for the hostile anti-Christian environment of university, how to maintain a solid Christian witness in a hostile environment, how to answer the tough questions, how to deal with everything from transgenderism, CRT, the LGBTQ, evolutionism, all that. And so we help them with worldviews and debating skills and how to build up their confidence to make a strong Christian stand in an anti-Christian environment. But then the Great Commission course, while including that, goes much further and deeper for those interested in cross-cultural missions. And so we've tended to put the two together, Biblical Worldview Summit, Great Commission course. They're both intensive, but the first week is aimed primarily at students and universities, and the next with people interested in being missionaries in the field.
Thank you. And the other question that I would have, we ask, we talk about the Great Commission course each December to see if people, yes, you know, want to go on the course, people who listen to our shows, etc. But The trouble is that might be late for some people because people have to book time off work, different things like that. To your knowledge, do you plan to hold the course at the same time next year? Or just to give people an idea that if they are interested, they've got more time to plan and how they could go about that.
Yes, certainly. And so we guarantee these camps stretch minds and muscles and people end off the course much, much, much fitter. You can imagine every day for 3 weeks, excepting Sundays, doing PT in the morning and then having hikes in the evening and outreach in the afternoon. It pulls people different directions. It's a real challenge to go through it. And while that can't be replicated online, people who want to listen to some of our lectures, like the presentations on CT Studd or Hudson Taylor and David Livingston and so on, they can go onto the www.frontlinemissionsa.org website, and we'll have on our audio and visio pages the audios and the videos of sermons, lectures, presentations given. Now, that doesn't include the unarmed combat. That doesn't include the archery, air rifle, sword fighting, practical things like that. It does include outreach in the streets. But the formal lectures given in the upper room hall, that people can benefit from, we're uploading them to Sermon Audio and to the Frontline YouTube and our website on a regular basis. So within a couple of weeks, we should have all 40 or 50 presentations up available for listeners and viewers who would like to tune into that. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And you have an email address as well. Would it be possible for people that are interested in the next Great Commission course or Biblical Worldview Summit to email you and for you to hold them on file until you've got definite dates for the next one so that they can then make their plans? Would that work for you?
Certainly. So my personal email is peter@frontline.org.za. So peter@frontline.org.za, that's my email. mission@frontline.org.za is the general email inquiry. But I can tell you it'll be the first 3 weeks of January next year. So it's always the first 3 weeks. This year we start on the 3rd. It's normally starting on the first Friday of each new year. So you can count it from the first 3 weeks of January will be the next one in 2026, God willing.
Yes, and the first Friday of January 2026 is the 2nd. Just got that page in my diary here. So, yeah, please bear that in mind, folks. It's something really amazing, and it's been very popular over the years. And, yes, the other thing I wanted to ask you, you talked about the diamonds and things like that in the Congo. I don't know if you've ever... Have you ever seen the Leonardo DiCaprio film Blood Diamond? And if so, is it accurate?
I have seen it, and I would say it's very accurate. I've even been to exactly where they filmed it. And I know that these things happen. I know the people involved. The only thing that is not accurate in the film is the depiction of the colonel in charge of the 3-2 Battalion as a non-Christian. That's not true. I know the colonel who founded 3-2 Battalion, Colonel Jan Breitenbach, an outstanding, dedicated Christian. So depicting the 3-2 Battalion commander as a mercenary kind of a godless man is not accurate. But otherwise, the film is accurate. That's exactly what happens, the chopping off of hands, the terrorism and so on. That's what was going on in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and being run, I might add, by American Negroes born in America who are terrorizing the local black people, enforcing a kind of Negro colonialism over the people in Liberia, where Africans were not allowed to vote or be government leaders. That was reserved for Americans of Negro descent alone could run the country. So Liberia is like an American Negro colony where they were exploiting and oppressing and enslaving the local black Africans, which is a story in and of itself. But yes, Blood Diamonds is well recommended. There's another film that helps you understand what's going on in the Congo, and that is The Dark of the Sun. The Dark of the Sun, based on a Wilbur Smith novel, that sort of depicts the kind of chaos that was going on in the Congo in the 1960s, massacres and murders and the diamond connection as well, and the United Nations' brutal role and how they really killed even more innocent people. So I think those are some good other films to watch. The Dark of the Sun, it's a Rod Taylor film. Blood Diamonds certainly will give you an insight to what we're dealing with in a lot of Africa with the Blood Diamond reality.
Thank you, Peter. And any last, you've given out your email address and your website. They're both included in the post for the show, along with some other websites of yours that are all very interesting. You have a Facebook page as well where people can contact you. Do you have any last message for the audience before we wrap it up?
Yes, I think we've got to remember that history is in many cases suppressed and ignored by the powers that should not be. And so we shouldn't depend on the mainstream, lamestream media for our news. We certainly shouldn't expect Hollywood to really give us the true story of what's going on or reflect reality. We need to do our own independent research. And so, you know, something like the Willem Gustloff, visit the Willem Gustloff Museum online. And when I say Willem Gustloff, you pronounce it more like Wilhelm Gustloff. But of course, the Germans would have pronounced the W's as a V. And because we speak Afrikaans here, we do the same thing in South Africa. So I've pronounced it Willem Gustloff, but it's obviously spelt Wilhelm Gustloff. And if you will check that out online, you will find that they've got a mountain of fascinating details. We mustn't forget the real victims of war crimes and atrocities. And we need to know our history so that we cannot be guilt manipulated, gaslighted, and Stockholm syndromed by the psychological warfare of the enemy. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Fascinating information as always. Okay, so we'll close it out. You have been listening to a presentation entitled The Real Story of the Sinking of the MV Wilhelm Gustloff 80 years ago on January the 30th, 1945. Peter and I will be back with you at the same time next Tuesday. I'll be back with you all tomorrow. And until then, folks, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day and bye for now.